Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by The Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center and a Bulwark contributor. My partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, professor of strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, emeritus, and a contributor to The Atlantic, is actually administering a PhD exam. We hope he may be able to join us later, but in case he can't, we'll just get going. I'd like to welcome our very special guest, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, Michael Froman, who has a very distinguished career in public service. He's been a deputy assistant secretary of the Treasury Department, chief of staff to Secretary of the Treasury Robert Rubin. He's been twice the dual-hatted deputy of the National Economic Council and the National Security Council under both presidents Obama and President Clinton. He has also been the U.S. Trade Representative, so eminently qualified now as the president of the Council on Foreign Relations to discuss a recent task force report of the Council, U.S. Economic Security Winning the Race for Tomorrow's Technologies. Michael Froman, welcome to Shield of the Republic.
Well, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
I wonder if we could start. We've on this show talked in the past about economic security. In fact, one of the task force members, Eddie Fishman, whose book Choke Points came out earlier this year, was a guest on the show. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why the council saw fit to empower this very illustrious group of folks to take on this subject of foundational technologies that the U.S. is involved in strategic competition for. And maybe you could talk a little bit about your selection process for those foundational technologies.
Sure. Well, first of all, we thought it was important, as we're seeing the convergence of economics and national security more broadly, to take on this issue of economic security head on, particularly at a time when our competition with China and this unprecedented competition across political, military, economic, and technological domains is reaching this this kind of pitch. This is, I think, one of the most important issues facing the country, and it comes down to, it's manifest in many different places, but it comes down in many respects to the competition over leadership in technology in particular sectors, particularly sectors and technologies that have dual use ramifications for both military and civilian use. And that led us to the selection of the three sectors, the three technologies in particular, AI, quantum, and biotech, that we chose. We could have gone broader. We could have gone into emerging energy technologies, any number of other technologies, but we decided to focus on those three, in part because they have such broad ramifications. that they cut across any number of use cases. And so whoever really dominates that area, who shows leadership in that area, whichever country does, is going to have a leg up in the competition. And we think the U.S. should work to win that competition. So that's why we chose those three.
Yes. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you touched on it in your opening comments there about the role of China. But the report makes the point that the United States has a lead in AI right now, but a diminishing lead. In quantum, arguably, Chinese may be slightly ahead of the U.S. And in biotech, again, maybe a U.S. has got an advantage now, but it's perhaps a wasting asset. Given Chinese levels of investment, could just describe a little bit about the effort that China is making in these areas.
Yeah, I think the competition is actually quite complicated because, as you said, let's take them one at a time. If we take AI, we are, of course, in the U.S. spending an enormous amount of money, investing an enormous amount of capital in AI, largely from the private sector, and largely on this search for alternative general intelligence or super intelligence. The most advanced models, the most advanced LLMs along that way. China is also trying to achieve alternative general intelligence, but it has invested quite a substantial amount of money, almost as much as the U.S. has, and has focused a great deal on the deployment of AI and the deployment of AI across its economy, from industry to industry and the whole management of the economy. So in many respects, they are ahead of the U.S. in terms of deploying AI and being poised to deploy the advances in AI through their economy, while we're very much focused on this race towards AI. AGI. You know, on quantum, I think that, again, the case is a bit more mixed. As I understand it, most of the significant new findings in quantum, the papers that are published by quantum scientists, are largely coming out of the U.S. Much of the innovation is coming out of the U.S. But in China, which has invested at least twice as much as the U.S. has in quantum, they are ahead in certain aspects of quantum communications devices, for example. And in biotech, the U.S. used to be the undisputed lead in terms of the patents that were filed, the innovations that were created, the businesses that were created, and we used to license out our IP to China for manufacturing. Over the last few years, that has begun to shift significantly, so that now we're licensing in to the United States 30% of what we produce from Chinese innovation. And in fact, China's producing as many patents as we are in the biotech area. So it has very much caught up in terms of being an innovator in this area, not just replicating what is being done elsewhere.
The text of the task force report talks about this, essentially the market failure that we've had in certain respects with these technologies, because in particular, biotech and quantum have long lead times, heavy investment in infrastructure to get going, with returns coming kind of late in the process. And the question is, should the United States government be taking a larger role in this? And one thing that I would say is a difference, for instance, from when you were in the Clinton administration and today, is that, and when I served, when dinosaurs walked the earth in the Reagan and Bush 41 administrations, where there used to be a predisposition against industrial policy, that the federal government should not be choosing winners and losers in new technologies. And even as recently as the Obama administration, when there were efforts being made by the Obama administration to invest in solar technologies, for instance, there has been a shift, I would say a huge shift on a bipartisan basis in favor now of industrial policy to keep up with the sort of level of investment that you've described that China's been making in these technologies. Can you talk a little bit about that, and as well the I thought very useful principles that the task force report lays out for how the government should think about these things? Because we've seen, of course, the current administration engaging in this, but in a way that I think some people find a little off-putting, a kind of predatory, extortionate seizure of either equity stakes in businesses or demand for profit sharing between government and the private sector. How ought we think about these problems?
Well, look, as you said, traditionally, there had been a great deal of skepticism in the U.S. about industrial policy, even as other countries, Europe, China, others pursued it, Japan over the years. You know, I mean, it's interestingly, you know, for years we used to lecture the Chinese not to engage in protectionism, not to restrict foreign investment, and not to engage in subsidization and industrial policy. And, you know, now we're engaged in protectionism, we're engaged in foreign investment constraints, and we're engaged in industrial policy. And it's a little bit of, if you can't beat them, join them, because if there's an unlevel playing field and China is determined to use all the tools that it has, and it has substantial tools, we can't simply stand by the on the sidelines. I think it does raise the question, well, when is it appropriate to use it and what are the tools to use? And because resources are not unlimited, and just throwing money at a particular problem or trying to pick a winner is unlikely to be fully successful, I think we've got to be selective. And I focus, and the report focuses on issues like where there's a market impediment or a market failure, where there's not going to be sufficient incentive for private sector investment, as you said, like quantum, where the benefits may be way down the road or the science is uncertain, or biotech, again, and where the benefits may be, it's maybe a public good, but may be hard for any particular company to justify the investment. I think it helps to be focused, and focus should start with national security, where there really is a core national security interest in seeing progress on that technology. You know, is it necessary for us to have industrial policy around PPE? You know, perhaps not. Of course, we'd like to have access to it readily, but maybe we can rely on other countries for that, or we can rely on other dynamics where some of these other issues are much closer to national security. Is it feasible that an investment and involvement by the U.S. government is going to achieve the objective, or is it beyond that capability? And what are the trade-offs? Again, resources are not unlimited. So you've got to be able to make choices and say, this technology is critical and is worth the investment, and at the expense of not investing in something else. And if you take those principles, I think hopefully you have some guardrails around when industrial policy might be appropriate.
Yeah, I mean, the report does single out, for instance, the Department of Defense's investment in some rare earth and magnet mining. That is absolutely essential for the Department of Defense for some of the high-performance weapons and munitions that we build, as one example among many. The other thing that I thought the report does an excellent job of covering in some detail is the supply chain vulnerabilities that we face. The report points out that during COVID, we all learned about supply chain vulnerabilities in a very kind of up close and personal way. But in more recent days, there's been a lot of focus on the supply chain vulnerabilities we face with regard to rare earths and the PRC's near monopoly of rare earths. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, in the sense that the report makes it very clear that we have not just adversary risk when it comes to supply chains, but there are some inputs that, you know, other countries than the United States that may be well disposed to the United States control, but still in a kind of uncomfortable way for us in extremis. But also that it's not just rare earths, that the PRC has in a lot of other inputs into things like quantum and biotech developed a very commanding position. So I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, look, I start from the premise that the number one rule of risk management anywhere, whether it's investing your stock portfolio or managing your national security, is diversification. You don't want to have all your eggs in one basket. And as you said, you certainly don't want to have your eggs in the basket controlled by your main competitor or adversary. But it's not just limited to that. We saw when there was a tsunami off of Japan and it interrupted the supply chains coming from Asia, that had an impact on the U.S. economy. And so part of this effort ought to be looking across critical products, whether it's for our military or for other purposes, and determining where do we have over-reliance on one supplier. For example, Taiwan and semiconductor production. Taiwan is friendly to us, of course. It's in a vulnerable position given its relationship with China. But even if it weren't, we would still want, I think, to have diversification of production. One of the things the report does, I think, quite well is identify that while there's been a lot of focus on chips and the Chips and Science Act was a critical step towards beginning to diversify the production of chips, the semiconductor supply chain is much broader and longer than just chips. And we need to look at each of those elements. If we're making chips in the U.S., but we still have to send them back to Asia to be packaged so that we can use them, that is not necessarily creating a newfound autonomy over our supply chain. And so we need to look at all of the inputs into the supply chain and where it's important that we either reshore to the U.S. or where we can rely on trusted allies and partners nearby or elsewhere in the case of extremists, so to make sure that we're getting access to what we absolutely need.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to overemphasize for our viewers and listeners how complex this can be, because supply chains now are dependent on a lot of different manufacturers of different inputs. I mean, I just know from my own efforts on the last two National Defense Strategy Commissions that talking to DOD officials about different weapon systems, I mean, they have difficulty even identifying where everything is in the supply chain. So it's a very complex process.
Absolutely. And it's not just your direct suppliers, but then you have to look beyond them to their suppliers and their suppliers. And you find somewhere way down the chain, there's some dependency on China, perhaps, for something that's absolutely critical to a military product. I think China has been quite strategic over the last few years of identifying where they think they have choke point capability, where they can cut off access. And this announcement that they made a couple of months ago about a new export control regime over not only the rare earth materials that they process, but even over the technology or the know-how that they've developed in the processing and applying that extraterritorially, sent a very clear signal to the rest of the global economy just how vulnerable we were. As you said, it's not just rare earths. That's just one product. And by the way, despite the name, we all know rare earths are not rare. They can be mined many places around the world. What China has done is really monopolize the processing of them. And they take rare earths from all over the world back to China for processing. And that's what we are currently dependent on. So that's where we need to see where to invest and where to create alternative sources of supply.
Of course, this is also where the trade-offs that you mentioned come into play, I think, because I don't think it's a dirty little secret. I think it's a pretty open secret. Is one of the reasons China ended up monopolizing so-called rare earths and in particular rare heavy earths and all that is this is a very dirty business that people don't want in their backyard. And so our own regulations and restrictions, permitting for things, certain kinds of facilities. Has become very onerous and very difficult in the United States. I wonder, if you might talk for a second about how much, because the report talks about permitting reform as one, one step for dealing with some of these supply chain deficiencies. How much does this overlap with the so-called abundance agenda that some people have been talking about? Because it strikes me that there's a kind of overlap here.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
This is Matt Rogers from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
Hey, Bowen, it's gift season.
Ugh, stressing me out. Why are the people I love so hard to shop for?
Probably because they only make boring gift guides that are totally uninspired. Except for the guide we made.
In partnership with Marshalls, where premium gifts meet incredible value.
It's giving gifts! With categories like best gifts for the mom whose idea of a sensible walking shoe is a stiletto.
Or best gifts for me that were so thoughtful I really shouldn't have.
Check out the guide on Marshalls.com.
And gift the good stuff at Marshalls.
Yeah, there is some overlap in terms of taking a hard look at the self-imposed obstacles. And by the way, self-imposed for a good reason, for environmental protection, for health and safety, et cetera, that has led us to become more dependent on China and other countries for some of these products. But I think that's what points back to the principles, which is where we need to be very focused and say, look, we're not going to eliminate regulation. Just for the sake of eliminating regulation. We're not going to try and make everything here in the United States that could be made elsewhere. But where the product is absolutely critical to national security, we should have that serious conversation about whether the trade-off is worth it. You know, it'll be more expensive than buying from someplace else. It may come into conflict with other policy objectives, like environmental protection in certain areas. And we ought to, through the democratic process, have that conversation about how much more we are willing to pay or what additional risk we're willing to take on in order to protect our national security, because no approach is absolutely free of charge. Every approach has its costs and benefits.
Another takeaway, at least for me, from the report is it's impossible for the United States to address this competition on its own. I mean, there's no way we can by ourselves keep up with the PRC on this for a variety of reasons, including scale. Yet, our alliances are very frayed in general. The most recent national security strategy, seems to very much downplay. It talks a lot about the importance of alliances, but then when it comes to specifics, it's sort of a lot of downplaying of alliances and a lot of wish casting, I think, about our alliances in the Indo-Pacific. We can't, this is my editorial comment, not yours, but, we can't make our Asian allies choose between being involved with the Chinese economy and ours. But we do want them kind of on side with us. And there's a tension, I think, in the Trump national security strategy on that point. But how from the point of view of the task force report, how should we think about allies as we, address this? And are things like the Pax Silica a real, answer to some of these supply chain concerns we have with the PRC?
So I do think, as you said, we will be able to compete better and compete at scale much more easily if we work closely with allies and partners. We can't do it really all on our own. And as you said, there are tensions in the alliances, including you didn't mention Europe, but certainly the national security strategy takes a pretty hard shot at Europe, and they're reeling from that currently. I have to say, personally, I am on the more optimistic end of the spectrum on this, because I think at the end of the day, national interests rule. And whether or not the Europeans are upset with the way they've been attacked by the Trump national security strategy, or whether our Asian Pacific allies are put in a difficult position of having to choose between the United States and China. Ultimately, they want to work and they need to work with the U.S. and their interests in national security are very much aligned with ours. So I'm kind of a realist here and hopeful that looking through the noise at the end of the day, our allies and partners will work with us because they need to and it's in their interest to, and they'll swallow their pride on other issues that may be bothering them.
The report talks about some mechanisms for doing this in terms of joint investments. And can you talk a little bit about that? What's the best way to try and work with partners and allies on these issues?
I think, first of all, identifying where there's opportunity, where others have technologies and others have investments or others have mines or processing potential. We should certainly be pursuing that aggressively. And this administration's done that. If you look at some of these so-called trade agreements that they've been negotiated around the world, they don't look necessarily like traditional trade agreements, but they have worked now set up a number of bilateral mechanisms, for example, on critical minerals, whether it's with Australia, Malaysia, Thailand, Japan, Korea, others. And that's helpful to say, okay, this is an agenda for cooperation between us. That can be joint investing. It can be sharing technology. It can be sourcing from processing that they're willing to do or that we're willing to provide. And so I think there are mechanisms where you can begin to bring together coalitions of the willing, so to speak, around cooperation on trusted supply chains for these key technologies.
Another topic that the report covers, I think, extremely well in each of these technologies, whether it's AI or quantum or biotech, is the human capital shortfalls that we face. Again, from my own work in the National Defense Strategy Commission. I mean, this is a problem we have in the defense industrial base, where we're short, for instance, 400,000 welders. The CFR report identifies a number of areas where we are going to be short. We're not going to be producing, you know, enough talent. How do you get after that problem? I mean, I know that's a big issue, and it goes to some degree beyond the remit of the task force, but there's a very interesting additional, an addendum or additional view of one of the task force members, Laura Tyson, former chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, who rightly, it seems to me, points out that, you know, it's tough to, you know, deal with these issues when you've got, currently an administration that is putting enormous stress on basic research by cutting off funding to key institutions that conduct that kind of basic research for the federal government, and has launched a major assault on our research universities that are kind of the crucible for so much of the kind of innovation that the task force report is looking for.
So I think it's a multidimensional problem, as you said. I mean, it's everything from welders to people in the lab doing the cutting edge research in our research universities and research institutes. And we need to have a comprehensive approach to it. I'd say, you know, some of that goes to issues, as you've identified, like investing in basic research and development through our great National Academies of Science and National Institutes of Health, the research universities. But it also goes to issues like selective immigration and making sure we've got the right talent. You know, we've been a magnet for talent from all over the world who want to come here and do research. We need that talent, and we should want to attract that talent and keep it here to continue to develop our industry and our capacity here after they've graduated or after they've done their research. And right now, that's not the approach the administration's taken between the cuts in R&D and the restrictions on immigration. We're putting ourselves, I think, in a bit of a hole. And I'm hopeful that over time, whatever the agenda is with the leading universities, that the administration will come around with support of Congress to refund, to fund again what needs to be done and to make it possible for the best talent in the world to come and stay here and strengthen the U.S. capacity to compete. But by the way, that's, as I said, it's a different problem than the welders, obviously. And there you need, you know, we've never had as much energy put into policy around how do we help workers thrive in a rapidly changing economy, and where do we need those skills? And again, whether those are technical education or apprenticeship programs or location-based economic development programs, mobility programs, private sector-led training, et cetera. There's a whole menu of possibilities out there, some of which other countries have done better than we have, in my view. And we should be looking to see what we need to do to ensure that our workers can compete in this rapidly changing economy.
Yeah, I mean, and again, one of the things I think the report does a great job on, for particularly for people who are sort of verging on being Luddites like I am, you know, it really identifies a lot of the key nodes in each of these different technologies that are required, the technology stack, as you describe it in the report, that's required in these areas. And, you know, there's a lot of just, you know, fundamental construction of facilities that's going to be required. I mean, AI, of course, is maybe the leading example of that, with all the data centers that were being, I live in Virginia, and in kind of central Virginia, and we're like ground zero for data centers. But that does also raise questions, it seems to me. I mean, I'm all in favor of, you know, permitting reform and making things easier to build. On the other hand, you know, the demand for electricity is so high. You're seeing this show up now as a political issue, with people raising questions about, okay, who bears the cost here of all this, you know, drain on electricity? Should it just be consumers, or should there be, you know, some equitable sharing of the cost with the, you know, AI companies that are awash right now in venture capital money?
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
This is Matt Rogers from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
Hey, Bowen, it's gift season.
Ugh, stressing me out. Why are the people I love so hard to shop for?
Probably because they only make boring gift guides that are totally uninspired. Except for the guide we made.
In partnership with Marshalls, where premium gifts meet incredible value.
It's giving gifts! With categories like best gifts for the mom whose idea of a sensible walking shoe is a stiletto.
Or best gifts for me that were so thoughtful I really shouldn't have.
Check out the guide on Marshalls.com.
And gift the good stuff at Marshalls.
Yes. No. Look, there's a lot in that question. I think it's going to require a comprehensive approach, because it's about generating, first of all, a lot more energy, getting it to the grid efficiently, which is has its own set of challenges, and then making sure, as you said, that it doesn't squeeze out small businesses or individuals because of the upward pressure on prices. It's one reason I think some of the hyperscalers have focused on building energy generation capacity as they build out their own data centers, so that they are contributing to the grid, or they're contributing their own energy to production at the same time that their demand is increasing. It's likely to lead to more efforts to find ways of being more efficient in managing energy around data centers as well, and to develop models that perhaps require less energy to train over time. So there's going to be pressure, I think, in all of these areas, given, as you say, the potential political ramifications of just constant upward pressure pressure on energy prices.
You know, as we've had this conversation, and as I read the task force report, which I really do commend, we'll put a link to the report in the show notes for the show. But I'm really struck by the complexity of all this. I mean, this is one of the more complex challenges facing government at a period of time where government capacity to meet challenges seems under enormous stress because of political polarization, but just the seeming inability of government to get, you know, big things, you know, done. One of the recommendations in the task force report is the creation of an economic security center in the Commerce Department. You know, you have a lot of experience in government dealing with these sort of cross-cutting, you know, issues where you've got a lot of different government departments involved and not a whole lot of coordination. And so I'm sure you have the scars of dealing with these kind of interagency, you know, coordination issues. Talk a little bit about how that would work and how hard will it be to get something like that done in the current political environment?
Sure. Well, first of all, I should say, you know, one of the most important things about this report and about the Council on Foreign Relations generally is that it is fully nonpartisan. And so our three co-chairs were Gina Raimondo, who was Secretary of Commerce in the Biden administration, Justin Muzinich, who was Deputy Secretary of Treasury in the Trump administration, and Jim Taiclet, who's the CEO of Lockheed. And that was very important. And one thing that both Gina and Justin noted from their respective government experiences, neither one of them had anyone that they could turn to and ask, what is our vulnerability to China? You know, what could China do with its choke points on our technology if it wanted to? And where are we particularly vulnerable? And they both agreed, and then the task force agreed, that some kind of center in the government and the Commerce Department was deemed the appropriate place where that kind of expertise could reside to really understand what are the supply chains for these critical technologies and how do we ensure that we've got access to diversified supply, that be created. Now, you're absolutely right. I've been in government on and off for 15 years in my adult life. And, you know, I think creating new things like this can be difficult, but we've done it. And I point to the fact that after 9/11, prior to 9/11, there had been a small office at the Treasury Department that dealt with money laundering and terrorism financing and things of that sort. After 9/11, it became a powerhouse institution across the U.S. government because there was a need for it, because there was a demand for it. And I think the current challenge facing the economic security of the U.S. is very much tantamount to the challenge that the country faced after 9/11 with regard to getting its arms around terrorism and terrorism financing. So I'm optimistic that this is something that could have bipartisan support. All of the recommendations in the report are really designed to generate bipartisan support. In fact, as the co-chairs say, you should start reading the report from the appendix backwards because it's really, as you said, very technical in terms of these are very specific, concrete things that can be done to address what could otherwise be seen as an overwhelming problem. And it's not overwhelming. It can be done. The last thing I would say is you were talking about how the U.S. government has a hard time getting things done these days, and that certainly is true. On the other hand, this is one of those key areas where it's going to be the nexus of the public and the private sector that takes us on. And the private sector, as we're seeing in the development of these new technologies like AI, like quantum, like biotech, and including the national security implications of those technologies, it's the private sector that is really, in many respects, taking the lead. And that gives me some optimism that we'll be able to work with government to get it done.
And it's one of the things the report points out, which is unlike our strategic competition with the Soviet Union during the Cold War, when it was largely government-driven research and development that was crucial to the military technical competition. Today, it's really all coming from the commercial sector of the economy, not the public sector. And we have to figure out how to harness that to the national interest. I wonder how You know, export controls is another thing that the report talks about, and the need both to maybe reduce the number of things subject to export control so we can focus on those things that are truly important, but also to raise the bar and cost for violations of export controls. I wonder, I know this happened since the report was completed, but how you see the administration's sort of reversal of the Biden administration's small yard, high fence policy, which is, to me, seems very consistent with the, you know, gravamen of this report, maybe not surprisingly, since Gina Raimondo was involved. But the decision to loosen up the export of NVIDIA's H200 chip series to China seems somehow to be at variance with what is, you know, being recommended in the report. And I wonder how you see that decision.
So I do think export controls have a critical role to play on those key technologies that have dual use national security implications, and where it's very important for us to retain leadership. And they should be constantly revised with, as they have been over decades. We've had export controls in place all through the Cold War to keep out of the Soviet Union's hands some of our key technologies and the Warsaw Pact. With China, it's an even greater challenge because they are a real economic and technological competitor as well. And so the approach to export control should be focused on, you know, what are the absolutely critical technologies that we need to retain control over at the expense that if we loosen that control would very much undermine our national security. And that's why I think the small yard, high fence analogy makes a lot of sense. You know, when it comes to chips, you know, the H200, as I understand it, is sort of our second most advanced chip made in the United States. And we have determined that being ahead in AI, being a leader on AI, and where the constraint is compute and where chips are the main input into that compute, that is of critical national security importance. So I think the decision to liberalize is surprising, and the decision to take an economic stake in liberalizing is unprecedented. We've over the years we've tried to keep export controls separate from, for example, trade policy or commercial policy. That this was all about national security, and whatever we wanted to sell to another country or increase exports of, that was a separate issue. This was not a chip to be used in those negotiations, and I do think that's what's appropriate when it comes to national security.
It's not even clear now whether the Chinese are going to, you know, accept that,
or another issue,
or raise the ante and demand the again, it's the Bakewell chip that
Blackwell, yeah,
Blackwell chip that they want, right? Well, we'll see how that plays out. We're kind of running a little short on time, and I want to be mindful of your time, Michael. But I wonder if you might comment, aside from the report, on the role you see for institutions like the Council on Foreign Relations in a period of time when those institutions are under attack, not just from the administration, but more broadly from the kind of anti-elitist, populist currents in our own politics. And really, those currents are not just confined to the United States. They're really kind of global. You see it in Europe. You see it in Asia as well.
Well, I think I take the question in two parts. One is, I think as a nonpartisan institution that produces independent research and analysis, I'm finding there's more demand for our product, for our content than ever before. Because in a very polarized environment, people are looking for some facts or how to interpret the various theories that are out there, and that's what we produce. And having a wide range of perspectives represented here is very important. I think on the issue of expertise and elitism, I think it's important for us and those of us in institutions like this to recognize that, one, we need to do a better job in engaging the rest of the public, not just the policymakers here in Washington, not just the leaders of finance or business or of the defense, et cetera, but really the rest of the American public, both to share information and expertise, but also to get input as to how they're looking at the role of the U.S. in the world. I mean, Americans have, and they've clearly expressed through recent elections, they have a wide range of perspectives on what role the U.S. should play in the world. How engaged should we be? What obligations we should take on? What should our allies take on? How do we deal with wars and conflicts abroad? And which ones should we get involved in and which ones are not? And a healthy democracy is going to require that we are very much engaged in a dialogue, not a monologue, with people around the rest of the country to get their perspective on this as well. I do find, though, as I travel around the country and I engage with communities, the American public is really quite sophisticated about the world. I mean, there's nobody more attuned to what's going on in the world than the American farmer. They totally get it. They know exactly what their product is and what it costs anywhere in the world, what the demand for it is, what the great trends are in globalization. And I just use the farmers as one example. You know, more and more, the American public understands what's going on around the rest of the world affects them. They have strong views about how we should engage in return. And that's important for institutions like ours to have our finger on that pulse and to reflect that in our work as well.
Well, I know that we here at Shield of the Republic have benefited a lot from the council. We've had any number of guests on who are either council fellows like Ray Takei, who has been my occasional co-author, mm-hmm. but we've also benefited from having a number of authors who've graced the pages of Foreign Affairs come and discuss their articles, whether it was Ann Neuberger recently on some of these issues with China, or Rush Doshi and Kurt Campbell, or Michael Beckley. We've benefited enormously from the council. So we're grateful for you and for its work. And thank you for joining us today on Shield of the Republic.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be taking a two-week break for the holidays. We want to wish everybody a happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, we hope a happy Kwanzaa, and whatever other holiday you may celebrate during this time period, and wish everybody a happy and healthy new year.
This holiday season, reach for the one butter that never disappoints. Kerrygold. Made with milk from grass-fed cows on Irish family farms, it's rich, creamy, and perfect for baking. Whether browning butter for cookies or crafting the flakiest pie crust, Kerrygold's high butterfat content makes all the difference in flavor and texture. Holiday treats will taste extraordinary.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.